This is Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We are reading from The Secret Garden, a novel by Frances Hodgson Burnett. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. We are pleased to present these dramatic readings of The Secret Garden using a cast of volunteer readers. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138. In today's program, we continue reading from Chapter 20. This is program number 7 in our 9-week presentation. Colin is excited about the prospect of going to the secret garden with Mary and Dickon. Colin has sent for the manor's head gardener, Mr. Roach, who has never seen Colin and has only heard about his disagreeable ways. Mr. Roach has been warned that Mary, Dickon, and Dickon's creatures will probably be in Colin's room. Your reader for Chapter 24 is Lydia Spityakov.
It was perhaps well he had been prepared, or he might have been startled. When the bedroom door was opened, a large crow, which seemed quite at home perched on the high back of a carven chair, announced the entrance of a visitor by saying, "Caw, caw," quite loudly. In spite of Mrs. Medlock's warning, Mr. Roach only just escaped being sufficiently undignified to jump backward. The young Rajah was neither in bed nor on his sofa. He was sitting in an armchair, and a young lamb was standing by him shaking its tail in feeding lamb fashion as Dickon knelt giving it milk from its bottle. A squirrel was perched on Dickon's bent back attentively, nibbling a nut. The little girl from India was sitting on a big footstool looking on. "Here is Master Roach, Master Colin." The young Rajah turned and looked his servitor over. At least that was what the head gardener felt happened. "Oh, you're Roach, are you?" he said. "I sent for you to give you some very important orders." "Very good, sir," answered Roach, wondering if he was to receive instructions to fell all the oaks in the park, or to transform the orchards into water gardens. "I'm going out in my chair this afternoon," said Colin. "If the fresh air agrees with me, I may go out every day. When I go, none of the gardeners are to be anywhere near the long walk by the garden walls. No one is to be there. I shall go out about 2 o'clock, and everyone must keep away until I send word that they may go back to their work." "Very good, sir," replied Mr. Roach, much relieved to hear that the oaks might remain and that the orchards were safe. "Mary," said Colin, turning to her, "what is that thing you say in India when you have finished talking and you want people to go?" "You say, 'You have my permission to go,'" answered Mary. The Rajah waved his hand. "You have my permission to go, Roach," he said, "but remember this is very important." "Caw, caw," remarked the crow hoarsely, but not impolitely. "Very good, sir. Thank you, sir," said Mr. Roach, and Mrs. Medlock took him out of the room. Outside in the corridor, being a rather good-natured man, he smiled until he almost laughed. "My word," he said, "he's got a fine lordly way with him, hasn't he? You'd think he was the whole royal family rolled into one, prince consort and all." "Eh," protested Mrs. Medlock, "we've had to let him trample all over every one of us ever since he had feet, and he thinks that's what folks was born for." "Perhaps he'll grow out of it if he lives," suggested Mr. Roach. "Well, there's one thing pretty sure," said Mrs. Medlock. "If he does live, and that Indian child stays here, I'll warrant she teaches him that the whole orange does not belong to him, as Susan Sowerby says, and he'll be likely to find out the size of his own quarter." Inside the room, Colin was leaning back on his cushions. "It's all safe now," he said, "and this afternoon I shall see it. This afternoon I shall be in it." Dickon went back to the garden with its creatures, and Mary stayed with Colin. She did not think he looked tired, but he was very quiet before their lunch came, and he was quiet while they were eating it. She wondered why, and asked him about it. "What big eyes you've got, Colin," she said. "When you are thinking, they get as big as saucers. What are you thinking about now?" "I can't help thinking about what it will look like," he answered. "The garden?" asked Mary. "The springtime," he said. "I was thinking that I've never really seen it before. I scarcely ever went out, and when I did go, I never looked at it. I didn't even think about it." "I never saw it in India, because there wasn't any," said Mary. Shut in and morbid as his life had been, Colin had more imagination than she had, and at least he had spent a good deal of time looking at wonderful books and pictures. That morning when you ran in and said, "It's come, it's come," you made me feel quite queer. It sounded as if things were coming with a great procession and big bursts and wafts of music. I've a picture like it in one of my books. Crowds of lovely people, and children with garlands and branches with blossoms on them. Everyone laughing and dancing and crowding and playing on pipes. That was why I said, "Perhaps we shall hear golden trumpets," and told you to throw open the window. "How funny," said Mary. "That's really just what it feels like. And if all the flowers and leaves and green things and birds and wild creatures danced past at once, what a crowd it would be. I'm sure they'd dance and sing and flute, and that would be the wafts of music." They both laughed, but it was not because the idea was laughable, but because they both so liked it. A little later, the nurse made Colin ready. She noticed that instead of lying like a log while his clothes were put on, he sat up and made some efforts to help himself. And he talked and laughed with Mary all the time. "This is one of his good days, sir," she said to Dr. Craven, who dropped in to inspect him. "He's in such good spirits, and that makes him stronger." "I'll call in again later in the afternoon after he's come in," said Dr. Craven. "I must see how the going out agrees with him. I wish," in a very low voice, "that he would let you go with him." "I'd rather give up the case this moment, sir, than even stay here while it's suggested," answered the nurse, with sudden firmness. "I hadn't really decided to suggest it," said the doctor, with his slight nervousness. "We'll try the experiment. Dickens, a lad I'd trust with a newborn child." The strongest footman in the house carried Colin downstairs and put him in his wheeled chair, near which Dickon waited outside. After the manservant had arranged his rugs and cushions, the Rajah waved his hand to him and to the nurse. "You have my permission to go," he said, and they both disappeared quickly, and it must be confessed, giggled when they were safely inside the house. Dickon began to push the wheeled chair slowly and steadily. Mistress Mary walked beside it, and Colin leaned back and lifted his face to the sky. The arch of it looked very high, and the small snowy clouds seemed like white birds floating on outspread wings below its crystal blueness. The wind swept in soft, big breaths down from the moor, and was strange with a wild, clear-scented sweetness. Colin kept lifting his thin chest to draw it in, and his big eyes looked as if they were listening instead of his ears. "There are so many sounds of singing and humming and calling out," he said. "What is that scent the puffs of wind bring?" "It's gorse on the moor that's opening out," answered Dickon. "Eh, the bees are at it wonderful today." Not a human creature was to be caught sight of in the paths they took. In fact, every gardener or gardener's lad had been witched away. But they wound in and out among the shrubbery, and out and round the fountain beds, following their carefully planned route for the mere mysterious pleasure of it. But when at last they turned into the long walk by the ivied walls, the excited sense of an approaching thrill made them, for some curious reason they could not have explained, begin to speak in whispers. "This is it," breathed Mary. "This is where I used to walk up and down and wonder and wonder." "Is it?" cried Colin, and his eyes began to search the ivy with eager curiousness. "But I can see nothing," he whispered. "There's no door." "That's what I thought," said Mary. Then there was a lovely, breathless silence, and the chair wheeled on. "That is the garden where Ben Weatherstaff works," said Mary. "Is it?" said Colin. A few yards more, and Mary whispered again. "This is where the robin flew over the wall," she said. "Is it?" cried Colin. "Oh, I wish he'd come again." "And that," said Mary, with solemn delight, pointing under a little lilac bush, "is where he perched on the little heap of earth and showed me the key." Then Colin sat up. "Where? Where?" "There," he cried, and his eyes were as big as the wolf's and Red Riding Hood, when Red Riding Hood felt called upon to remark upon them. Dickon stood still, and the wheeled chair stopped. "And this," said Mary, stepping onto the bed close to the ivy, "is where I went to talk to him when he chirped at me from the top of the wall. And this is the ivy the wind blew back." And she took hold of the hanging green curtain. "Oh, is it? Is it?" gasped Colin. "And here is the handle. And here is the door. Dickon, push him in. Push him in quickly." And Dickon did it with one strong, steady, splendid push. But Colin had actually dropped back against his cushions. Even though he gasped with delight, and he had covered his eyes with his hands and held them there, shedding out everything until they were inside and the chair stopped, as if by magic, and the door was closed. Not till then did he take them away and look round and round, as Dickon and Mary had done, and over the walls and earth and trees and swinging sprays and tendrils of the fair green veil of tender little leaves had crept, and in the grass under the trees, and the gray urns in the alcoves, and here and there everywhere were touches or splashes of gold and purple and white, and the trees were showing pink and snow above his head, and there were fluttering of wings and faint sweet pipes of humming and scents, and the sun fell warm upon his face like a hand with a lovely touch. And in wonder Mary and Dickon stood and stared at him. He looked so strange and different, because a pink glow of color had actually crept all over him, ivory face and neck and hands and all. "I shall get well! I shall get well!" he cried out. "Mary, Dickon, I shall get well, and I shall live forever and ever and ever."
"As it is, I must leave you in care of my brother, the wizard who lives on the hill, who has promised his art will soon pierce through the heart of this dragon that's keeping you ill. And I know that your mother, God bless her, would want you to do as he says and grow strong. And you know that as soon as I can I'll return. So be brave, son, and know that I long to race you to the top of the morn. Come, sit on my shoulders and ride. Run and hide, I'll come and find you. Climb hills to remind you I love you.
We will now continue our reading of The Secret Garden with Chapter 21. Your reader is Fred Corlett.
Chapter 21. Ben Weatherstaff. One of the strange things about living in the world is that it is only now and then one is quite sure one is going to live forever and ever and ever. One knows it sometimes when one gets up at the tender, solemn dawn time and goes out and stands alone and throws one's head far back and looks up and up and watches the pale sky slowly changing and flushing and marvelous, unknown things happening until the east almost makes one cry out and one's heart stands still at the strange, unchanging majesty of the rising of the sun, which has been happening every morning for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. One knows it then for a moment or so, and one knows it sometimes when one stands by oneself in a wood at sunset, and the mysterious deep gold stillness slanting through and under the branches seems to be saying slowly again and again something one cannot quite hear, however much one tries. Then sometimes the immense quiet of the dark blue at night, with millions of stars waiting and watching, makes one sure, and sometimes a sound of far-off music makes it true, and sometimes a look in someone's eyes. And it was like that with Colin when he first saw and heard and felt the springtime inside the four high walls of a hidden garden. That afternoon the whole world seemed to devote itself to being perfect and radiantly beautiful and kind to one boy. Perhaps out of pure heavenly goodness the spring came and crowded everything it possibly could into that one place. More than once Dickon paused in what he was doing and stood still with a sort of growing wonder in his eyes, shaking his head softly. "Eh, it is Grayley," he said. "I'm 12 going on 13, and there's a lot of afternoons in 13 years, but seems to me like I never seed one as Grayley as this one here." "Aye, it is a Gradely one," said Mary, and she sighed for mere joy. "I'll warrant it's the Gradeliest one ever was in this world." "Does the think," said Colin, with dreamy carefulness, "as happen it would make like this here all on a purpose for me?" "My word," cried Mary admiringly, "that there is a bit of good Yorkshire. Thou'rt shapen first rate, and that thou art." And delight reigned. They drew their chair under the plum tree, which was snow-white with blossoms and musical with bees. It was like a king's canopy, a fairy king's. There were flowering cherry trees near, and apple trees whose buds were pink and white, and here and there one had burst open wide. Between the blossoming branches of the canopy, bits of blue sky looked down like wonderful eyes. Mary and Dickon worked a little here and there, and Colin watched them. They brought him things to look at, buds which were opening, buds which were tight closed, bits of twig whose leaves were just showing green, the feather of a woodpecker which had dropped on the grass, an empty shell of some bird early hatched. Dickon pushed the chair slowly round and round the garden, stopping every other moment to let him look at wonder springing out of the earth or trailing down from trees. It was like being taken in state round the country of a magic king and queen, and shown all the mysterious riches it contained. "I wonder if we shall see the robin," said Colin. "Thou'll see him often enow after bit," answered Dickon. "When the eggs hatches out and the little chap, he'll be kept so busy it'll make his head swim. Thou'll see him flying backward and forward, carrying worms nigh as big as himself, and that much noise going on in the nest when he gets there as fair flusters him, so he scarce knows which big mouth to drop the first piece in, and gaping beaks and squawks on every side. Mother says as when she's seen the work a robin has to keep them gaping beaks filled, she feels like she was a lady with nothing to do. She says she's seen the little chaps when it seemed like the sweat must be dropping off 'em, though folk can't see it." This made them giggle so delightedly that they were obliged to cover their mouths with their hands, remembering that they must not be heard. Colin had been instructed as to the law of whispers and low voices several days before. He liked the mysteriousness of it and did his best, but in the midst of excited enjoyment, it is rather difficult never to laugh above a whisper. Every moment of the afternoon was full of new things, and every hour the sunshine grew more golden. The wheeled chair had been drawn back under the canopy, and Dickon had sat down on the grass and just drawn out his pipe, when Colin saw something he had not had time to notice before. "That's a very old tree over there, isn't it?" he said. Dickon looked across the grass at the tree, and Mary looked, and there was a brief moment of stillness. "Yes," answered Dickon, after it and his low voice had a very gentle sound. Mary gazed at the tree and thought, "The branches are quite gray, and there's not a single leaf anywhere," Colin went on. "It's quite dead, isn't it?" "Aye," admitted Dickon. "But them roses, as has climbed all over it, will near hide every bit of the dead wood when they're full of flowers and leaves. It won't look dead then. It'll be the prettiest of all." Mary still gazed at the tree and thought. "It looks as if a big branch had been broken off," said Colin. "I wonder how it was done." "It's been done many a year," answered Dickon. "Eh?" And with a suddenly relieved start and laying his hand on Colin, "Look at that robin! There he is! He's been foraging for his mate." Colin was almost too late, but he just caught sight of him, the flash of red-breasted bird with something in his beak. He darted through the greenness and into the close-grown corner and was out of sight. Colin leaned back on his cushion again, laughing a little. "He's taking her tea to her. Perhaps it's 5 o'clock. I think I'd like some tea myself." And so they were safe. "It was magic which sent the robin," said Mary secretly to Dickon afterward. "I know it was magic." For both she and Dickon had been afraid Colin might ask something about the tree whose branch had broken off 10 years ago, and they had talked it over together, and Dickon had stood and rubbed his head in a troubled way. "We mun look as if it wasn't no different from the other trees," he had said. "We couldn't never tell him how it broke, poor lad. If he says anything about it, we mun try to look cheerful." "Aye, that we mun," answered Mary. But she had not felt as if she looked cheerful when she gazed at the tree. She wondered and wondered in those few moments if there was any reality in that other thing Dickon had said. He had gone on rubbing his rust-red hair in a puzzled way, but a nice, comforted look had begun to grow in his blue eyes. "Mrs. Craven was a very lovely young lady," he had gone on rather hesitatingly. "And Mother, she thinks maybe she's about Misselwaite
many a time looking after Mr. Colin, same as all mothers do when they're took out in the world. They have to come back, they sees. Happen she's been in the garden, and happen it was her set us to work, and told us to bring him here. Mary had thought he meant something about magic. She was a great believer in magic. Secretly, she quite believed that Dickon worked magic. Of course, good magic, on everything near him. And that was why people liked him so much, and wild creatures knew he was their friend. She wondered, indeed, if it were not possible that his gift had brought the robin just at the right moment when Colin asked that dangerous question. She felt that his magic was working all the afternoon and making Colin look like an entirely different boy. It did not seem possible that he could be the crazy creature who had screamed and beaten and bitten his pillow. Even his ivory whiteness seemed to change. The faint glow of color which had shone on his face and neck and hands when he first got inside the garden really never quite died away. He looked as if he were made of flesh instead of ivory or wax. They saw the robin carry food to his mate two or three times, and it was so suggestive of afternoon tea that Colin felt they must have some. "Go and make one of the men servants bring me a basket in the rhododendron walk," he said, "and then you and Dickon can bring it here." It was an agreeable idea, easily carried out, and when the white cloth was spread upon the grass, with hot tea and buttered toast and crumpets, a delightfully hungry meal was eaten, and several birds on domestic errands paused to inquire what was going on and were led into investigating crumbs with great activity. Nut and Shell whisked up trees with pieces of cake, and Soot took the entire half of a buttered crumpet into a corner and pecked at it and examined it and turned it over and made hoarse remarks about it until he decided to swallow it all joyfully in one gulp. The afternoon was dragging toward its mellow hour. The sun was deepening the gold of its lances. The bees were going home, and the birds were flying past less often. Dickon and Mary were sitting on the grass. The tea basket was repacked, ready to be taken back to the house, and Colin was lying against his cushions with the heavy locks pushed back from his forehead, and his face looking quite a natural color. "I don't want this afternoon to go," he said, "but I shall come back tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after." "You'll get plenty of fresh air, won't you?" said Mary. "I'm going to get nothing else," he answered. "I've seen the spring now, and I'm going to see the summer. I'm going to see everything grow here. I'm going to grow here myself." "That thou will," said Dickon. "Us'll have thee walkin' about here, and diggin' same as other folk afore long." Colin flushed tremendously. "Walk?" he said. "Dig? Shall I?" Dickon's glance at him was delicately cautious. Neither he nor Mary had ever asked if anything was the matter with his legs. "For sure thou will," he said stoutly. "Thou's got legs of thine own, same as other folks." Mary was rather frightened until she heard Colin's answer. "Nothing really ails them," he said, "but they are so thin and weak. They shake so that I'm afraid to try to stand on them." Both Mary and Dickon drew a relieved breath. "When thou stops being afraid, thou'll stand on them," Dickon said with renewed cheer, "and that'll stop being afraid in a bit." "I shall," said Colin, and he lay still, as if he were wondering about things. They were really very quiet for a little while. The sun was dropping lower. It was that hour when everything stills itself, and they really had had a busy and exciting afternoon. Colin looked as if he were resting luxuriously. Even the creatures had ceased moving about and had drawn together and were resting near them. Soot had perched on a low branch and drawn up one leg and dropped the gray film drowsily over his eyes. Mary privately thought he looked as if he might snore in a minute. In the midst of this stillness, it was rather startling when Colin half lifted his head and exclaimed in a loud, suddenly alarmed whisper, "Who is that man?" Dickon and Mary scrambled to their feet. "Man!" they both cried in low, quick voices. Colin pointed to the high wall. "Look!" he whispered excitedly. "Just look!" Mary and Dickon wheeled about and looked. There was Ben Weatherstaff's indignant face glaring at them over the wall from the top of a ladder. He actually shook his fist at Mary. "If I wasn't a bachelor, and thou was a wench o' mine," he cried, "I'd give thee a hidin'." He mounted another step threateningly, as if it were his energetic intention to jump down and deal with her. but as she came toward him, he evidently thought better of it and stood on the top step of the ladder, shaking his fist down at her. "I never thought much of thee," he harangued. "I couldn't abide thee the first time I set eyes on thee. A scrawny, buttermilk-faced young bosom, allus asking questions and poking the nose where it wasna wanted. I never knowed how thou got so thick with me, if it hadn't been for the robin, drat him." "Ben Weatherstaff," called out Mary, finding her breath. She stood below him and called up to him with a sort of gasp. "Ben Weatherstaff, it was the robin who showed me the way." Then it did seem as if Ben really would scramble down on her side of the wall, he was so outraged. "Thou young baden," he called down at her, "layin' thy badness on a robin. Not but what he's impotent enough for anything. Him showin' thee the way. Him, ha! That young knout." He could see his next words burst out because he was overpowered by curiosity. "However in this world did I get in?" "It was the robin who showed me the way," she protested obstinately. "He didn't know he was doing it, but he did, and I can't tell you from here while you're shaking your fist at me." He stopped shaking his fist very suddenly at that very moment, and his jaw actually dropped as he stared over her head at something he saw coming over the grass toward him. At the first sound of his torrent of words, Colin had been so surprised that he had not only sat up and listened, as if he were spellbound, but in the midst of it he had recovered himself and beckoned imperiously to Dickon. "Wheel me over there," he commanded. "Wheel me quite close, and stop right in front of him." And this, if you please, this is what Ben Weatherstaff beheld, and which made his jaw drop. A wheeled chair with luxurious cushions and robes which came toward him looking rather like some sort of state coach, because a young rajah leaned back in it with royal command in his great black-rimmed eyes, and a thin white hand extended haughtily toward him, and it stopped right under Ben Weatherstaff's nose. It was really no wonder his mouth dropped open. "Do you know who I am?" demanded the rajah. How Ben Weatherstaff stared! His red old eyes fixed themselves on what was before him, and he was seeing a ghost. He gazed and gazed and gulped a lump down his throat and did not say a word. "Do you know who I am?" demanded Colin, still more imperiously. "Answer!" Ben Weatherstaff put his gnarled hand up and passed it over his eyes and over his forehead, and then he did answer in a queer, shaky voice. "Who thou art?" he said. "Aye, that I do. With thy mother's eyes staring out at me at thy face. Lord knows how thou come here, but thou art the poor cripple." Colin forgot that he had ever had a back. His face flushed scarlet, and he sat bolt upright. "I'm not a cripple," he cried out furiously. "I'm not." "He's not," cried Mary, almost shouting up the wall in her fierce indignation. He's not got a lump as big as a pin. I looked, and there was none there, not one." Ben Weatherstaff passed his hand over his forehead again, and gazed as if he could never gaze enough. His hand shook, and his mouth shook, and his voice shook. He was an ignorant old man, and a tactless old man, and he could only remember things he had heard. The hasn't got a crooked back?" he said hoarsely. "No!" shouted Colin. The hasn't got crooked legs?" quavered Ben, more hoarsely yet. It was too much. The strength which Colin usually threw into his tantrums rushed through him now in a new way. Never yet had he been accused of crooked legs, even in whispers, and the perfectly simple belief in their existence which was revealed by Ben Weatherstaff's voice was more than rajah flesh and blood could endure. His anger and insulted pride made him forget everything but this one moment, and filled him with a power he had never known before, an almost unnatural strength. "Come here!" he shouted to Dickon, and he actually began to tear the coverings off his lower limbs and disentangle himself. Come here, this minute!" Dickon was by his side in a second. Mary caught her breath in a short gasp and felt herself turn pale. "He can do it! He can do it! He can do it! He can!" she gabbled over to herself under her breath as fast as ever she could. There was a brief, fierce scramble. The rugs were tossed on the ground. Dickon held Colin's arm. The thin legs were out. The thin feet were on the grass. Colin was standing upright. Upright! As straight as an arrow and looking strangely tall. His head thrown back and his strange eyes flashing lightning. "Look at me!" he flung up at Ben Weatherstaff. "Just look at me, you!" Just look at me. He's as straight as I am, cried Dickon. He's as straight as any lad in Yorkshire. What Ben Weatherstaff did, Mary thought queer beyond measure. He choked and gulped, and suddenly tears ran down his weather-wrinkled cheeks as he struck his old hands together. "Eh," he burst forth, "the lies folks tell. Thou'rt as thin as a lath, and as white as a wraith, but there's not a knob on thee. Thou'lt make a man yet. God bless thee." Dickon held Colin's arm strongly, but the boy had not begun to falter. He stood straighter and straighter, and looked Ben Weatherstaff in the face. "I'm your master," he said, "when my father is away, and you are to obey me. This is my garden. Don't dare to say a word about it. You get down from that ladder and go out to the long walk, and Miss Mary will meet you and bring you here. I want to talk to you. We did not want you, but now you have to be in the secret. Be quick." Ben Weatherstaff's crabbed old face was still wet with that one queer rush of tears. It seemed as if he could not take his eyes from thin, straight Colin, standing on his feet with his head thrown back. "Eh, lad," he had whispered, "eh, my lad." And then, remembering himself, he suddenly touched his hat gardener fashion and said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir," and obediently disappeared as he descended the ladder.
When a thing is wick, it has a life about it. Now maybe not a life like you and me, but somewhere there's a single streak of green inside it. Come and let me show you what I mean. When a thing is wick, it has a light around it. Maybe not a light that you can see, but hiding down below, sparks asleep inside it, waiting for the right time to be seen. You clear away the dead parts so the tender buds can fall. Loosen up the earth and let the roots get warm. Let the roots get warm.
We will now continue our reading of The Secret Garden with Chapter 22. Your reader is Heather Boggs.
Chapter 22, When the Sun Went Down. When his head was out of sight, Colin turned to Mary. "Go and meet him," he said, and Mary flew across the grass to the door under the ivy. Dickon was watching him with sharp eyes. There were scarlet spots on his cheeks, and he looked amazing, but he showed no signs of falling. "I can stand," he said, and his head was still held up, and he said it quite grandly. "I told thee that thou could as soon as thou stopped being afraid," answered Dickon. "And thou stopped." "Yes, I've stopped," said Colin. And then suddenly he remembered something Mary had said. "Are you making magic?" he asked sharply. Dickon's curly mouth spread in a cheerful grin. "Thou's doing magic thyself," he said. "It's the same magic as made these air work out all the earth," and he touched with his thick boot a clump of crocuses in the grass. Colin looked down at them. "Aye," he said slowly, "there couldn't have been bigger magic than that there. There couldn't have been." He drew himself up straighter than ever. "I'm going to walk to that tree," he said, pointing to one a few feet away from him. "I'm going to be standing when Weatherstaff comes here. I can rest against the tree if I like. When I want to sit down, I will sit down, but not before. Bring a rug from the chair." He walked to the tree, and though Dickon held his arm, he was wonderfully steady. When he stood against the tree trunk, it was not too plain that he supported himself against it, and he still held himself so straight that he looked tall. When Ben Weatherstaff came through the door in the wall, he saw him standing there, and he heard Mary muttering something under her breath.
"What art sayin'?"
he asked rather testily, because he did not want his attention distracted from the long, thin, straight boy figure and proud face. But she did not tell him. What she was saying was this. You can do it. You can do it. I told you you could. You can do it. You can do it. You can. She was saying it to Colin because she wanted to make magic and keep him on his feet looking like that. She could not bear that he should give in before Ben Weatherstaff. He did not give in. She was uplifted by a sudden feeling that he looked quite beautiful in spite of his thinness. He fixed his eyes on Ben Weatherstaff in his funny, imperious way. "Look at me," he commanded. "Look at me all over. Am I a hunchback? Have I got crooked legs?" Ben Weatherstaff had not quite got over his emotion, but he had recovered a little and answered almost in his usual way. "Not tha," he said. "Nowt o' the sort. What's tha been doin' with thyself, hidin' out o' sight and lettin' folk think thou was a cripple and half-witted?" "Half-witted," said Colin angrily. "Who thought that?" "Lots o' fools," said Ben. "The world's full o' jackasses brayin', and they never bray, not but lies. What did that shut thyself up for?" "Everyone thought I was going to die," said Colin shortly. "I'm not." And he said it with such decision. Ben Weatherstaff looked him over, up and down, down and up. "Tha die?" he said with a dry exultation. "Not of the sort. Tha's got too much pluck in thee. When I seed thee put thy legs on the ground in such a hurry, I knowed thou was all right. Sit thee down on the rug and a bit, young meester, and give me thy orders." There was a queer mixture of crabbed tenderness and shrewd understanding in his manner. Mary had poured out speech as rapidly as she could as they had come down the long walk. The chief thing to be remembered, she had told him, was that Colin was getting well. Getting well! The garden was doing it. No one must let him remember about having humps and dying. The Rajah condescended to seat himself on a rug under the tree. "What work do you do in the gardens, Weatherstaff?" he inquired.
"Anything I'm told to do," answered old Ben. "I'm kept on my favor, because she liked me."
"She?" said Colin.
"The mother," answered Ben Weatherstaff.
"My mother?" said Colin, and he looked up about him quietly. This was her garden, wasn't it?
"Aye, it was that," said Ben Weatherstaff, looking about him too. "She were main fond of it."
"It is my garden now. I am fond of it. I shall come here every day," announced Colin. "But it is to be a secret. My orders are that no one is to know that we come here. Dickon and my cousin have worked and made it come alive. I shall send for you sometimes to help, but you must come when no one can see you."
Ben Weatherstaff's face twisted itself in a dry old smile. "I've come here before when no one saw me," he said.
"What?" exclaimed Colin. "When?"
"The last time I was here," rubbing his chin and looking round, "was about 2 years ago."
"But no one has been in it for 10 years, cried Colin. "There was no door."
"I'm no one," said old Ben dryly, "and I didn't come through a door. I came over the wall. The rheumatics held me back the last 2 year."
"Tha came and did a bit of prunin'," cried Dickon. "I couldn't make out how it had been done."
"She was so fond of it, she was," said Ben Weatherstaff slowly.
"And she was such a pretty young thing. She says to me once, 'Ben,' says she, laughing, 'if I ever I'm ill or I go away, you must take care of my roses.' When she did go away, the orders was no one was to ever come nigh. But I come, with grumpy obstinacy. Over the wall I come, until the rheumatic stopped me. And I did a bit of work once a year. She'd gave me her order first.
It wouldn't have been a week as it is if it tha hadn't done it," said Dickon.
"I did wonder." "I'm glad you did it, Weatherstaff," said Colin. "You'll know how to keep the secret."
"Aye, I'll know, sir," answered Ben. "And it'd be easier for a man with rheumatics to come in at the door."
On the grass near the tree, Mary had dropped her trowel. Colin stretched out his hand and took it. An odd expression came into his face, and he began to scratch at the earth. His thin hand was weak enough, but presently, as they watched him, Mary with quite breathless interest, he drove the end of the trowel into the soil and turned some over.
"You can do it. You can do it," said Mary to herself. "I tell you, you can."
Dickon's round eyes were full of eager curiousness, but he said not a word. Ben Weatherstaff looked on with interested face. Colin persevered. After he had turned a few trowelfuls of soil, he spoke exultantly to Dickon in his best Yorkshire.
"Tha said as tha'd have me walkin' about here same as other folk, and tha said tha'd have me diggin'. I thought thou was just leadin' to please me. This is only the first day, and I've walked, and here I am diggin'."
Ben Weatherstaff's mouth fell open again when he heard him, but he ended by chuckling.
"Hey," he said, "that sounds as if thou'd got wits now. Thou'rt a Yorkshire lad for sure, and thou'rt diggin' too. How thou'd like to plant a bit o' something. I can get thee a rose in a pot."
"Go and get it," said Colin, digging excitedly. "Quick, quick!" It was done quickly enough, indeed. Ben Weatherstaff went in his way, forgetting rheumatics. Dickon took his spade and dug the hole deeper and wider than a new digger with thin white hands could make it. Mary slipped out to run and bring back a watering can. When Dickon had deepened the hole, Colin went in turning the earth softer over and over again. He looked up at the sky, flushed and glowing with the strangely new exercise, slight as it was.
"I want to do it before the sun goes quite down," he said.
Mary thought that perhaps the sun held back a few minutes just on purpose. Ben Weatherstaff brought the rose in its pot from the greenhouse. He hobbled over the grass as fast as he could. He had begun to be excited, too. He knelt down by the hole and broke the pot from the mold.
"Here, lad," he said, handing the plant to Colin. "Set it in the earth, thy cell, same as thy king does when he goes to a new place."
The thin white hands shook a little, and Colin's flush grew deeper as he set the rose in the mould and held it, while old Ben made firm the earth. It was filled in and pressed down and made steady. Mary was leaning forward on her hands and knees. Soot had flown down and marched forward to see what was being done. Nut and Shell chattered about it from a cherry tree.
"It's planted," said Colin at last, "and the sun is only slipping over the edge. Help me up, Dickon. I want to be standing when it goes. That's part of the magic."
And Dickon helped him, and the magic, or whatever it was, so gave him strength that when the sun did slip over the edge and end the strange lovely afternoon for them, there he actually stood on his two feet, laughing.
Come to my garden, rest there.
We will now continue our reading of The Secret Garden with Chapter 23. Your reader is Ken Walsh.
Chapter 23, Magic. Dr. Craven had been waiting for some time at the house when they returned to it. He had indeed begun to wonder if it might not be wise to send someone out to explore the garden paths. When Colin was brought back to his room, the poor man looked him over seriously. "You should not have stayed so long," he said. "You must not overexert yourself." "I'm not tired at all," said Colin. "It has made me well. Tomorrow I am going out in the morning as well as in the afternoon."
"I'm not sure that I can allow that," answered Dr. Craven. "I'm afraid it would not be wise."
"It would not be wise to try to stop me," said Colin quite seriously. "I am going." Even Mary had found that one of Colin's chief peculiarities was that he did not know in the least what a rude little brute he was, with his way of ordering people about. He had lived in a sort of desert island all his life, and as he had been the king of it, he had made his own manners and had had no one to compare himself with. Mary had indeed been rather like him herself, and since she had been at Misselwaite, had gradually discovered that her own manners had not been of the kind which is usual or popular. Having made this discovery, she naturally thought it of enough interest to communicate to Colin. So she sat and looked at him curiously for a few minutes after Dr. Craven had gone. She wanted to make him ask her why she was doing it, and of course she did. "What are you looking at me for?" he said. "I'm thinking that I am rather sorry for Dr. Craven."
"So am I," said Colin calmly, but not without an air of some satisfaction. "He won't get Misselwaite at all now. I'm not going to die."
"I'm sorry for him because of that, of course," said Mary. "But I was thinking just then that it must have been very horrid to have had to be polite for 10 years to a boy who was always rude. I would never have done it."
"Am I rude?" Colin asked undisturbedly.
"If you had been his own boy, and he had been a slapping sort of man," said Mary, "he would have slapped you."
"But he daren't," said Colin.
"No, he daren't," answered Mistress Mary, thinking the thing out quite without prejudice. "Nobody ever dared to do anything you didn't like, because you were going to die and things like that. You are such a poor thing." Announced Colin stubbornly. "I am not going to be a poor thing. I won't let people think I'm one. I stood on my feet this afternoon."
"It is always having your own way that has made you so queer," Mary went on, thinking aloud.
Colin turned his head, frowning. "Am I queer?" he demanded.
"Yes," answered Mary, "very. But you needn't be cross," she added impartially, "because so am I queer, and so is Ben Weatherstaff. But I am not as queer as I was before I began to like people, and before I found that garden."
"I don't want to be queer," said Colin. "I am not going to be," and he frowned again with determination. He was a very proud boy. He lay thinking for a while, and then Mary saw his beautiful smile begin and gradually change his whole face.
"I shall stop being queer," he said, "if I go every day to the garden. There's magic in there. Good magic, you know, Mary. I'm sure there is."
"So am I," said Mary. "Even if it isn't real magic," Colin said, "we can pretend it is. Something is there, something."
"It's magic," said Mary, "but not black. It's as white as snow."
They always called it magic, and indeed it seemed like it in the months that followed. The wonderful months, the radiant months, the amazing ones. All the things that happened in that garden. If you had never had a garden, you cannot understand. And if you have had a garden, you will know that it would take a whole book to describe all that came to pass there. At first it seemed that green things would never cease pushing their way through the earth, in the grass, in the beds, even in the crevices of the walls. Then the green things began to show buds, and the buds began to unfurl and show color. Every shade of blue, every shade of purple, every tint and hue of crimson. In its happy days, flowers had been tucked away into every inch and hole and corner. Ben Weatherstaff had seen it done and had himself scraped out mortar from between the bricks of the wall and made pockets of earth for lovely clinging things to grow on. Iris and white lilies rose out of the grass in sheaves, and the green alcoves filled themselves with amazing armies of the blue and white flower lances of tall delphiniums, or columbines, or campanulas. "She was main fond of them, she was," Ben Weatherstaff said. "She liked them things as was always pointing up to the blue sky," she used to tell. "Not that she was one of them as looked down on the earth, not her. She just loved it, but she said as the blue sky always looked so joyful." The seeds Dickon and Mary had planted grew as if fairies had tended them. Satiny poppies of all tints danced in the breeze by the score, gaily defying flowers which had lived in the garden for years, and which it might have been confessed, seemed rather to wonder how such new people had got there. And the roses, rising out of the grass, tangled round the sundial, wreathing the tree trunks and hanging from their branches, climbing up the walls and spreading over them with long garlands falling in cascades. They came alive day by day, hour by hour, fair fresh leaves and buds, tiny at first, but swelling and working magic until they burst and uncurled into cups of scent, delicately spilling themselves over their brims and filling the garden air. Colin saw it all, watching each change as it took place. Every morning he was brought out, and every hour of each day when it didn't rain he spent in the garden. Even gray days pleased him. He would lie on the grass watching things growing, he said. If you watch long enough, he declared, you could see the buds unsheath themselves. Also, you could make the acquaintance of such strange, busy insect things running about on various unknown but evidently serious errands, sometimes carrying tiny scraps of straw or feather or food or climbing blades of grass as if they were trees whose tops one could look out to explore the country, a mole throwing up its mound at the end of its burrow and making its way out at last with the long-nailed paws, which looked so like elfish hands, had absorbed him one whole morning. Ants' ways, beetles' ways, bees' ways, frogs' ways, birds' ways, plants' ways, gave him a new world to explore, and when Dickon revealed them all, and added foxes' ways, otters' ways, ferrets' ways, squirrels' ways, and trouts and water rats and badgers' ways, there was no end to the things to talk about and think over. And this was not the half of the magic. The fact that he had really once stood on his feet had set Colin thinking tremendously, and when Mary told him of the spell she had worked, he was excited and approved of it greatly. He talked of it constantly. "Of course, there must be lots of magic in the world," he said wisely one day, "but people don't know what it is like or how to make it. Perhaps the beginning is just to say nice things are going to happen until you make them happen. I am going to try an experiment." The next morning, when they went to the secret garden, he sent at once for Ben Weatherstaff. Ben came as quickly as he could and found the Rajah standing on his feet under a tree and looking very grand, but also very beautifully smiling. "Good morning, Ben Weatherstaff," he said. "I want you and Dickon and Miss Mary to stand in a row and listen to me, because I am going to tell you something very important."
"Aye, aye, sir," answered Ben Weatherstaff, touching his forehead. One of the long-concealed charms of Ben Weatherstaff was that in his boyhood he had once run away to sea and had made voyages, so he could reply like a sailor. "I am trying to make a scientific experiment," explained the Rajah. "When I grow up, I am going to make great scientific discoveries, and I am going to begin now with this experiment."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said Ben Weatherstaff promptly, though this was the first time he had heard of great scientific discoveries. It was the first time Mary had heard of them either, but even at this stage she had begun to realize that, queer as he was, Colin had read about a great many singular things and was somehow a very convincing sort of boy. When he held up his head and fixed his strange eyes on you, it seemed as if you believed him almost in spite of yourself, though he was only 10 years old, going on 11. At this moment, he was especially convincing, because he suddenly felt the fascination of actually making a sort of speech like a grown-up person. "The scientific discoveries I am going to make," he went on, "will be about magic. Magic is a great thing, and scarcely anyone knows anything about it, except a few people in old books. And Mary a little, because she was born in India, where they're fakirs. I believe Dickon knows some magic, but perhaps he doesn't know he knows it. He charms animals and people. I would never have let him come to see me if he had not been an animal charmer, which is a boy charmer, too, because a boy is an animal. I am sure there is magic in everything, only we have not sense enough to get hold of it and make it do things for us, like electricity and horses and steam." This sounded so imposing that Ben Weatherstaff became quite excited and really could not keep still. "Aye, aye, sir," he said, and began to stand up quite straight. When Mary found this garden, it looked quite dead, the orator proceeded. "Then something began pushing things up out of the soil and making things out of nothing. One day things weren't there, and another they were. I had never watched things before, and it made me feel very curious. Scientific people are always curious, and I am going to be scientific. I kept saying to myself, 'What is it? What is it? It's something. It can't be nothing. I don't know its name, so I call it magic. I have never seen the sunrise, but Mary and Dickon have, and from what they tell me, I am sure it is magic too. Something pushes it up and draws it. Sometimes, since I've been in the garden, I've looked up through the trees at the sky, and I have had a strange feeling of being happy, as if something were pushing and drawing in my chest and making me breathe fast. Magic is always pushing and drawing and making things out of nothing. Everything is made out of magic. Leaves and trees, flowers and birds, badgers and foxes and squirrels and people. So it must be all around us, in this garden, in all the places. The magic in this garden has made me stand up, and now I know I am going to live to be a man. I am going to make the scientific experiment of trying to get some and put it in myself and make it push and draw me and make me strong. I don't know how to do it, but I think that if you keep thinking about it and calling it, perhaps it will come. Perhaps that is the first baby way to get it. When I was going to try the stand that first time, Mary kept saying to herself, as fast as she could, 'You can do it, you can do it,' and I did. I had to try myself at the same time, of course, but her magic helped me, and so did Dickens, every morning and evening, and as often in the daytime as I can remember, I am going to say, 'Magic is in me, magic is making me well. I am going to be as strong as Dickon, as strong as Dickon. And you must all do it, too. That is my experiment. Will you help, Ben Weatherstaff?' 'Aye, aye, sir,' said Ben Weatherstaff. 'Aye, aye.'
By the hedge, cut it back. Dig a hole, try to fill it. Plant a rose, tie it back. Find a mole, try to kill it. It's a maze, this garden, it's a maze of ways, and a man can spend his day. It's a maze, this garden, it's a maze of paths, but a soul can find the way. For an old man.
Thank you for listening to our feature presentation, The Secret Garden. That's all the time we have for today's readings. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of this classic work by Frances Hodgson Burnett, and will join us next time as we continue readings from The Secret Garden. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you want more information about TRRS or our programming, please visit our website at trianglereadingservice.org or call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. On behalf of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, I'm Kurt Benrood.
The roses climb a sublime the time when an English garden grows.